It's been a huge privilege to share God's word with you over these last few days. And today we're going to look at Jesus' two-minute masterpiece in Luke chapter 16, verses 19 to 31. And what we've been doing each time is we've been looking at the setting, then the story, and then the significance. Well, the setting you should already be getting used to now at this point, because we've been dealing with that the last 2 days. The setting is that we have a story told, somewhat addressed to the Pharisees from 16 verse 14. You can see that where Jesus is turning to them, the Pharisees and scribes. I presume everyone's still there listening, but Jesus is addressing people who like the Bible, like religious rules, and like money. And so that's the group he is talking to. So let's read this amazing story, Luke chapter 16, verses 19 to 31. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen, and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. And in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side. And he called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish. And besides all this, between us and you a great chasm has been fixed, in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may pass from there to us." And he said, "Then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come to this place of torment." But Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them." And he said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead." Well, it's an amazing story, and as we've seen previously, there are connections between a number of the stories. We see here Lazarus longing to be filled. Have we had anyone recently in a recent story longing to be filled? Oh yes, that was the prodigal son. And what's so interesting is that the Lazarus is longing to be filled, and then along come the dogs, and that the prodigal son was longing to be filled with the stuff from the pigs. So there's a parallel between pigs and dogs, and this is only in Luke, okay? Now, do we have a parallel between pigs and dogs anywhere else in the New Testament? Oh, yes, we do. In the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, "Don't give what's holy to the dogs, or give your cast your pearls before pig swine." You see, and that's only in Matthew. And so you suddenly see that this is like the fingerprint of Jesus's mind. So what I want to do is point out some of the reasons. Think these things really come from Jesus. They're just masterpieces from him. There are other things. You see that the rich man sees afar off. Have we seen anyone seeing afar off recently? Oh yes, that was the father in the story of the prodigal son, wasn't it? He saw afar off. And what's the rich man doing every day? He's celebrating. Have we had any celebration recently? Oh yes, the shepherd celebrated when he found the sheep. The woman celebrated when she found the coin. The father celebrated when he found his son. And his older brother wanted to celebrate with his friends. Okay, so all of these themes are running through. Even the use of father, three times. He calls Abraham father, just as three times the prodigal son called him father. And Abraham calls him child, just as the father calls child to the older son. So lots and lots of language overlapping between these two. Let's get into the story. There was a certain rich man. And he has, we don't know much about him, but this is the description. Clothes of purple and fine linen, and he feasted every day. Now, let's think like scribes. Are there any places in the Bible where you get purple and fine linen and feasting every day? Oh, yes, Esther 1:6, you say, I know, because that's where Ahasuerus, Xerxes, has this big 180-day-long feast and then an extra sort of 7-day feast at the end of that. And it describes the decorations there, doesn't it? But the interesting thing, therefore, is that this rich man seems to be treating himself like a king, but there's a contrast because bad Ahasuerus, Xerxes, invited everyone. All the men were invited. It wasn't an exclusive feast. So there's a nice contrast there already. Then we see that he seems to be excessive in the way that he's doing things. He's feasting every day. Do we have anyone else who feasts every day? Well, one possibility, of course, is Job's children. Now, one reading is that, you remember, there are 7 sons and 3 daughters, and Job 1, verses 4 to 5, maybe we'll read that get a sense of what's going on there. There are different ways of understanding it, but they seem to be feasting pretty regularly. And Job 1, verses 4 and 5, what we get is, his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send to invite their 3 sisters and eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and they would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. Now, that could be that there are 7 of them, and therefore they have 1 day per brother, and so they have a 7-day week, and they feast every day. But anyway, we'll get on to that. The rich man is not named. We don't know what his name is. No doubt he was pretty famous. That's what rich men tend to be. But who gets named in this story? Lazarus. Because we see that whereas to society, the rich man was the important person and Lazarus was not. As far as God's concerned, Lazarus was the important person. It's that beautiful way you get in the story of the Exodus where we know the names of the midwives, Shifra and Puah, and we don't know the name of the Pharaoh. Isn't that really cool? Like that Pharaoh is supposed to be the really big dude, but the people who go down in history are Shifra and Puah, who rescued the young boys. And then we see that the cleverness, as Jesus tells this story, because he can give you so much detail in such a short space. He tells you that as this man is feasting every day, that at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus. He was laid. Just one word. Interesting. Because there we realize that Lazarus has a severe mobility disability. But it doesn't dwell on that. It just tells you that. Somehow he's been put there as a seemingly strategic place to get mercy. We also see that he's at the gate of the rich man's house. So we can imagine this sort of gated area, this enclosure. But there's only one gate. Every time that rich man wants to go out of his house, he has to go past Lazarus. And every single time he goes in and out, he ignores him. Then we read that the rich man, that Lazarus was covered with sores. Is there anyone in the Bible who's covered with sores? Anyone know anyone covered with sores? You allowed to shout out? Job. That's right. Was Job rich or poor? He was rich. But the interesting thing is Job could say in Job chapter 31, I've always fed the poor. We've got 2 rich people mentioned in this story, Abraham and Job. Abraham was an amazing host to completely random people who turned up. They weren't completely random, it was God. But the point is, when people that he didn't know turned up, he was an amazing host. And because he hosted God and God's no man's debtor, God puts him in charge of the heavenly feast, you see? God, it's interesting, I love the story of Abraham. You know, God only had one friend? One friend? There's only one person who's called friend of God. Now, Jesus calls his disciples friends, but only one person called friend of God, and that's Abraham. But God did a really good job on the friendship. Like, he blessed everyone who comes into contact with Abraham. But, you know, through him, all the nations on earth will be blessed. So think about that just in terms of your friendship. It's not about having large numbers of friends. It's about doing a really good job on the friendship. That's what God did. Of course, he loves us, and that's good. So this man is covered with sores, but we don't know why he's poor. Was it his own fault? Doesn't matter, does it? We often like to distinguish between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, and the Bible never does that. Then we're told that the poor man died. Who dies first? The poor man. What does he die of? Starvation? The sores? Poor people generally do die first. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. What an amazing thing that the poor man is treated like a VIP by the angels. And it says the rich man also died and was buried. It didn't tell you that the poor man was buried, did it? Was he buried or not? You're sort of wondering, was he buried? Well, you can imagine that for the rich man, there was a big ceremony. Lots of people came. But for the poor man, there were the angels. God sent his angels to give him a VIP reception to Abraham's side. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? The rich man died, he's buried, and he goes to Hades. Now, when Jesus says Hades, that's an interesting word, Greek word, and you think, doesn't that sound like Greek mythology? Now, when Jesus says Hades, he doesn't mean all the stuff about the fluffy dog and, you know, the man you're supposed to pay a coin to ferry you over the river and that sort of stuff. None of that. But there was one thing that the Greeks got very correct in their idea of Hades, and that is an exact payback for evil. And what we see here is that the rich man has an exact payback for what he's done. Lazarus had burning sores, and along came the tongues of the dogs and licked them. And the rich man has a burning tongue and is in pain. Lazarus was begging, and now the rich man is begging. Lazarus could see the feasting. Now the rich man can see the feasting. Oh, except I've been calling him the rich man, but he's not. Because the interesting thing is, when it says in verse 22, the rich man also died and was buried, that's the last time he's called the rich man. After that, he's always he, because he's not rich anymore. And also, it's the last time Lazarus is called the poor man, because when he gets to Abraham's side, he's not poor anymore. So this man who was rich is now in torment. And it says that he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus at his side. Is there anywhere in the Bible that we get someone lifted up their eyes and saw afar off? Oh, let's turn to Genesis chapter 22. Genesis chapter 22. This is an interesting thing because this is where Abraham is tested by God. And what we get is this, that Genesis 22 verse 4, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. So we got four things in common, lifting up eyes, seeing from afar, and Abraham. They're all there. The only other place we get lifting up eyes from afar is, of course, when Job's friends lift up their eyes from afar. You can see that in Job chapter 2. So we're reminded through these echoes of these Old Testament stories. So he lifts up his eyes and he sees Lazarus and he sees Abraham. And Lazarus is said to be at Abraham's side. Some older translations might say Abraham's bosom. I'd imagine in different European translations, there'll be a slightly different emphasis. And it's an awkward word because we don't have the word in English. In John 1:18, when it says that the Son is at the Father's side, or in John 13, where it will talk about the beloved disciple, John 13, verse 23, at the side of Jesus, What you've got to imagine is people reclining at a feast. And as they recline, the whole of the front of them, people recline next to each other. So someone's back is next to someone's front. That's what it means. When it says Abraham's side, Abraham's bosom, it's not that Abraham is a super big person, okay? Abraham is a normal-sized Abraham. There is one slot, only one slot next to him at the feast. And who's got it? Lazarus. Not Moses, not David, not Samuel, not Elijah. Lazarus? What? That's absurd. I mean, how can this beggar who's so worthless, so insignificant, how can he get the slot next to the greatest VIP that you could imagine? I mean, who would be better to feast with than Abraham? That's extraordinary. But that's what happens. That's what's described in this story, that he sees Abraham afar off and Lazarus there at his side. Now, the rich man sees two people, Lazarus and Abraham. One of them he's met before, and the other he hasn't. So who should he talk to? He talks to Abraham. He never talks to Lazarus. He talks about Lazarus, but he never talks to Lazarus. He wants to talk rich man to rich man, except he's not a rich man anymore. But he thinks he's going to talk to the man with status. Oh, Lazarus. Oh, Abraham. I'm in agony. Send Lazarus to dip his finger into water and bring it to me to cool my tongue. Can you imagine how much agony he's in? That he's just wanting to have that slight relief. How much water can you get on the tip of a finger? Not a lot, is it? But that's how much in pain he is. He thinks it's worthwhile just to have that. But it's interesting that he's still treating Lazarus like a servant, a lackey, an errand boy. He thinks it's worth Lazarus's time to come all the way with that bit of water just for him. Because the universe still revolves around him as far as he's concerned. So we see how this man is so selfish, so self-absorbed. He says, have mercy on me, Abraham. Well, you never had mercy on Lazarus. Send Lazarus. Oh, you know his name. That's interesting. Suddenly that name becomes interesting, a potentially useful piece of information. All his life, he'd ignored him and gone in and out of the gate. He had never invited him in, not once. Oh, you think, you don't really want to start inviting him in because, you know, he'll start hanging around even more, won't he? And, you know, if you give him one meal, he'll never go away. So you imagine how this man rationalizes, and so he never ends up helping Lazarus. This man is not reformed in Hades, in hell. It's not that he stops sinning. It's not that he stops being selfish and self-absorbed. But he's in agony, and he wants just that drop of water on his tongue. And he tells Abraham to send Lazarus. But Abraham says, there's a chasm. It can't happen. Now, the really amazing thing is this, that Abraham says that there's a chasm so that those who want to go from where Abraham is to where the formerly rich man is can't go. That's really strange. Why would anyone want to go from where Abraham is to where the formerly rich man is? Unless they've become so like Christ that they're prepared to give up the bliss of heaven in order to suffer and help others. Isn't it interesting? It talks about people who would want to leave where Abraham is temporarily in order to help others, but they can't. There's a chasm. Then the rich man begs. You see the poetic justice. The poetic justice is so strong here. Just as Lazarus used to beg, so this man is begging. Lazarus just wanted crumbs. This man just wants that little bit of water. And he says, Father, Abraham, send Lazarus to my father's house. Notice two uses of father there. That's surprising because it shows us that the man is not totally self-absorbed. He actually cares about his family. Don't think that when he feasted, he always feasted alone. No, he was a family man. He was concerned about his family as he wants them to be warned. I have five brothers, he says. I want them warned. I don't want them to come here. There's a mathematical mistake there. How many brothers does he have? He thinks he's got five. Now, if you're a scribe and you hear the number five, what do you think of the five? You think of the five books that you most often copy out, the five books of the law, particularly since Jesus has basically mentioned those in verse 16 and 17, immediately preceding this story. In the five books of the law, well, if you're going to call Abraham father, how many kids does Abraham have? An awful lot. So if again and again he wants to say, Father Abraham, Father Abraham, go and send it to my five brothers. Big mistake there, isn't it? Because if you want to claim Abraham as your father, you have to recognize Lazarus as your brother. So he has got this constrained view of family. The cozy view of family. Just he and his immediate blood relatives, and he thinks that's it. And the challenge here is to recognize that if you want to claim Abraham as your father, then you have to say that Lazarus is your brother too. Abraham has uncountable offspring. Abraham says, they have Moses and the prophets. I love the way Abraham is talking about Moses. That's really cool. He points them to scripture. The once rich man says, no, Father Abraham, your theology is wrong. That's quite a thing, isn't it? You know, arguing with Abraham on theology. I mean, arguing with God's friend on theology. And why is he God's friend? Because God reveals his plan to Abraham. The pride that there is to think that Abraham's wrong and he's right. If someone just rises from the dead, they'll be convinced. Now, this is beautiful because we read this story in the context of the whole gospel, where Christ goes to the cross and he rises from the dead, and do people believe? Often, I think we can feel at a disadvantage. We think if only we were there around at the time when Jesus walked this earth, And then we could believe. But one thing that's really clear here in Luke is just how the scriptures are enough. And by the way, that's exactly the point you get in John chapter 20. John chapter 20, when Jesus says to Thomas, because you've seen, you've believed, but more blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. The scriptures written there so that people can believe. We've actually got, in some ways, a clearer view than apostles had because we have the whole scriptures together. And we have their evidence. And we have so much of the speech of Jesus, the patterns of his speech. We can know him through the scriptures. His speech has fingerprints, if you like. I've been trying to point out the ways he talks, and you can know him, the way he thinks, through the scriptures. And if they don't believe the scriptures, they're not going to believe if someone rises from the dead. So what does this story mean for us today? Well, it doesn't mean it's wrong to be rich. Abraham was rich. Job was rich. God is infinitely rich. It doesn't mean it's wrong to feast. Abraham feast. And it doesn't mean that you get to heaven by being poor. But no doubt there will be an awful lot of reversals relative to the way things are here, in the here and now, the way they will be in the future. And it also, I don't think, is teaching us that people can have conversations between heaven and hell. But it does give us some important spiritual principles. We'll think about money, think about family, and we'll think about scripture. First, about money. There's a problem with the love of money, not money itself. As it says in Matthew chapter 13, verse 22, about the seed sown among thorns, it says, "This is the one who hear the words, the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it proves unfruitful." The idea that riches actually deceive. It's also an idea we get in 1 Timothy 6, verse 9 and 10. "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and it's through this craving that some have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." One of the things that riches tend to do is blind us. Now, there are some people who God has given a lot of wealth to and have a lot of spiritual insight. And they can be incredibly generous. But often we find that the more we have, the less clearly we see. That's why when we're looking for spiritual advice, it's often good to look for spiritual advice from people who aren't overwhelmed by having too many things. And we see with these Pharisees that they knew their Bibles, but they still loved their status. They loved money. They had that whole system of comfort. Within evangelicalism, you can make a good career. You can make good money in evangelicalism, in all sorts of ministries. Okay, most ministries not. I'll accept that. But it's really important for us to recognize that we need to be attached to God and not to wealth and money. This temporarily rich man did not have a heavenly investment. He was rich on earth, but he wasn't thinking longer term. Secondly, about family. It's important for us to recognize spiritual brothers and sisters. Very easily, we can constrain those that we think we're attached to. But God's put us in this amazing group, his church, with hundreds of millions, possibly billions, of people who are serving him. And there are brothers and sisters, and yes, because of our finite human nature, we can't know all of their names and we can't relate to them all. That's not what we're supposed to. But the thing about the rich man and Lazarus is Lazarus was at his gate every day. It's not that you have to feel responsible for every single poor person in the entire world. We're not capable of doing that. But Lazarus was at his gate, and that meant it was his job to look after him. There are people that God will put around us, and it's our job to care for them. And we need to sometimes get outside of those comfy sets of relationships that we have and recognize those that God is putting into our lives. Thirdly, about the scriptures. I hope you can see from this story and some of the other stories the value of studying the scriptures, that Christ studied the scriptures. He brought the scriptures into his own stories, and it's really worthwhile to do so. So we as Christians in Europe, if we're going to see a reformation, if we're going to see Europe coming back to Christ, we need to get back to the scriptures. We need to get back to confidence in the scriptures. We need to recognize that this is the bedrock. And easily we can just drift away from that because it doesn't necessarily seem very contemporary, may not seem very cool, but we need to recognize there's such a richness here, and we need to have a reformation towards the scriptures and then recognize that they have the evidence, the reasons to believe. Now, one of the frustrations I have is that I think I know so many reasons there are to believe the Christian faith, and yet you can't explain them to most people because they don't know the Bible, because a lot of them are there. When you know the Bible a bit more, you can sort of explain how this bit and this bit, and it's really amazing, yeah? So this is a frustration. But let's recognize what God's given to us, this wealth of stuff in the scriptures. Let's get into it. Let's study our Bibles more and recognize that this gives us the confidence, it gives us the understanding of God that we can then go out and reach others with. We need, before we start thinking about educating the entire world about the Bible, we need to make sure that we are studying the scriptures. But of course, the scribes and Pharisees studied the scriptures. But they studied the scriptures and rationalized them. Again and again, they had ways of reading things so that they didn't need to transform their lives. "Who is my neighbor?" asked the lawyer, so he can have a comfy view of what the scriptures teach, and he can somehow constrain that law about loving your neighbor to be a bit more manageable. The scribes and Pharisees here in this story, they knew the scriptures, and yet they could easily build up their system in which they were getting richer and richer and didn't really need to do anything practically. Jesus was sentenced to death by a group of Bible experts. So people can know the scriptures and not be transformed by them. So we need a reformation towards the scriptures, and it needs to be changing our lives. We need God to come in and to revive our hearts so that we are obedient to the scriptures, putting them into practice, having full confidence in them, but not just knowing the detail, but also living it out. Christ knew the scriptures and he knew his task, and he paid the ultimate price. He suffered more than any of us could possibly imagine. He took our hell, because it wasn't just head knowledge, it was lived out. We need to live our lives in a cross-shaped manner, taking up our cross and following him, recognizing that the scriptures guide us, and we need to take up their challenge to make difficult decisions and walk in the path of Christ, because he's done everything for us.